It's a pleasure to have Armin Tavakoli with us today, who is now in Vienna, and he will be talking to us about entanglement in prepare and measure scenarios. So thanks.
Okay, so let me just check one more time. You can see my cursor, is that right? Yeah, good. Okay, so thanks for having me. I'm Armin. I wanted to give a talk about entanglement in prepare and measure scenarios, which is a quite long-term project that I've been doing with three collaborators, Jeff Pauwels, who is a PhD student in Brussels, and Eric Woodhead, who is a postdoc in Brussels, and Stefano Pironio, who is leading the group in Brussels. So the topic here is going back to a very simple type of experiment that you often encounter in physics, quite ubiquitously, the prepare and measure scenario, which I abbreviate the PM scenario. It's really the most basic type of communication experiment that you can encounter. And for simplicity, I call the two parties that it involves Alice and Bob. In a prepare and measure experiment, you say that Alice has some classical data called X. And this she uses to encode some sort of message that she then communicates to Bob. Bob can then ask a question about Alice's data, which is called Y. And based on her message, he can try to answer it. And that answer is called B. This is the basic prepare and measure scenario. And often we also allow Alice and Bob to have an additional resource, namely shared randomness, which I denote here by lambda. This is a source of classical correlation that Alice and Bob can use in order to coordinate their messaging and answering strategies. And it's generally a cheap resource, which can even be based on an external physical phenomena that they can both observe. The prepare and measure scenario, as I said, appears in a lot of places in physics and quantum information science in particular, and it's useful for a whole lot of things. Just a few examples I put in this list are random number generation and quantum key distribution protocol. Also self-testing schemes where you try to decide properties of your preparations or measurements or channels based on the statistics they produce, or certification, which more generally tries to tell you something about quantum devices based on how they perform. Another application is called communication complexity, where you try to share a lot of information using as little communication as possible. Other well-known tasks are random access coding, where you try to learn something about the database using minimal communication, and also contextuality problems, which is, I'm sure, well-known to my audience here. There are also many frameworks in which you can look at the prepare and measure scenario, and many of them have been investigated quite disjointly from each other. The perhaps most well-researched one is the dimension-based one, where you say that, well, the communication that comes from Alice to Bob has to have a given physical dimension. If it's classical, it's maybe binary, zero or one. If it's quantum, maybe it's a qubit or a qubit or something similar. The dimension can be restricted. But there are also entirely different approaches where you instead try to limit, for example, the energy or the amount of trust you have in one device, or the amount of information that the device emits about some input, or the amount of, well, obliviousness, which pieces of the data, say X, are hidden in the communication. So there is different frameworks and there are different applications, but in essence, it's many ways of regarding the same prepare and measure scenario. What we do is to go back to the prepare and measure scenario once again, but this time consider it in a more general setting. The change here is that our source of shared randomness, which so often is included for free in analysis of prepare and measure scenarios, is now substituted with something much more powerful, namely a source of quantum entanglement, a state I call phi. So now we want to ask, what type of correlations can you expect to see in a prepare and measure scenario where you don't only prepare independently, but you can use a share of an entangled state in order to coordinate your messaging and answering strategies? As in all cases, we have to say under what type of assumptions we operate. It should always be noted that if you don't assume anything about a prepare and measure scenario, you can trivialize everything and don't really learn anything about the physics. What I mean by that is that if you don't assume anything, you can always have Alice sending her input X over some channel and having Bob answer any question about it that he wants. So to do interesting physics, you must always have some assumption. And here we are going to work with the, well, most popular one is a start really in our systematic approach to prepare and measure scenarios with entanglement. And that is once again the limited dimension of the communication channel to be either a classical d-dimensional system or a quantum d-dimensional system. Of course, when you say entanglement-assisted quantum communication, the first thing that comes to mind is quantum dense coding, which is really the paradigmatic example of how this can be useful. So as you all probably know, dense coding allows you to take one qubit of communication over the channel and have a singlet shared between Alice and Bob and allow you to send 2 bits of classical information just by virtue of having the singlet assisting your qubit communication. So it's well known that entanglement can do something for you when it comes to improving communications. And of course, after dense coding, entanglement-assisted communications has received quite a bit of research. The most prominent one, I believe, is entanglement-assisted channel capacities, where you try to say something about how well, how reliably you can send information over a given channel in the limit of asymptotically many users. Another example, which is based on classical communication, is how you can use entanglement to improve the efficiency of communication over a classical channel so you can more effectively perform tasks using a limited amount of information. But to our surprise, and I would be very happy to hear if you have more information on this matter, was that very little seemed to be known to us about prepare and measure scenarios with entanglement beyond the dense coding scenario in the one-shot case that we are looking here now. That is not in the asymptotic limit that in which you consider channel capacities. So once we noticed this, we sort of set up an approach where we wanted to systematically look into prepare and measure scenarios with entanglement. And that is really the topic that I'm talking about here. So I'll formalize this a little bit more. I'm going to call the qubit, or not qubit rather, the quantum system, which is part A of the entanglement, A. The other part I call B, and the communication I'm going to call C. So if you set up a simple model for this communication, it looks essentially like this. Alice can apply some channel based on her input. This channel maps the incoming share of the entangled state into the communication. So this channel is constrained by the fact that the dimension of the communication is limited. And in essence, it creates a total state on Bob's side that looks like this. It's composed of the share he received from an entangled state and whatever he received through the communication channel. Then on this total state, Bob can perform a measurement, MY, which gives you quantum correlations based on the ordinary Born rule. So the degrees of freedom you have are the shared entangled state, phi, the channels of Alice, and the measurements of Bob. As a special case of this, of particular interest, is when the communication over the channel is classical. This time, you have to perform a measurement on the incoming system here in order to then send a classical bit or a classical dit over the channel. So this type of classical channel amounts to exactly making a measurement, getting some outcome C, and sending that over the channel. It means that the total state that ends up on Bob's side is on one share, the thing, the classical message that came over the channel, and on one share, the post-measurement quantum state ending up on his lab after Alice performs her measurement. So in total, you end up with this classical quantum state, and once again, you get your quantum correlations from the Born rule. Here, we want to understand what these correlations can look like in the most general scenarios in prepare and measure experiments. So the first question is this: how much does dense coding already tell us about these sorts of problems? There are some easy answers. If you have only 2 messages or 2 inputs, 3 inputs or 4 inputs, you can use dense coding to just send your entire input to Bob, and every question about your data that you might have can be answered. So if you ever want to hope at finding correlations that are more general than dense coding, you have to have at least 5 inputs for Alice. And here I have used a slightly inconvenient notation, which is useful later. So I use 2 bits to denote the first 4 inputs of Alice, and then a 5 for denoting the last one. So here we are going to show that there exist scenarios where dense coding is quite suboptimal when it comes to understanding the limits of quantum correlations based on qubit communication. To this end, we make up a task. The task is this: when Alice has one of the 4 first inputs and Bob asks for a question 1 or 2, The goal is to answer the wife bit of Alice. So if Bob's input is one, then the goal is to answer zero because the bit of first bit of Alice is zero. Similarly, if his input is two and Alice has the second input, then the goal is to answer one, namely the second bit of Alice's input. Now, when Bob does the third measurement, the goal is to distinguish the fifth input from the other four. This is a constraint. So under the constraint, you can always distinguish the fifth input from the other four. How well could you ever answer this question? That is, what is the wife bit of Alice's input? This is the game that we have tailored in order to reveal the advantage of more general communication that goes beyond dense coding. So we studied the success probabilities in this rather contrived task and found the following.
Armin, can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
If Y is one or two, but X was five, what's the task?
Then there is no task. We just ignore it.
Okay,
so we studied the success probabilities that you can have it in this task based on different resources. First, of course, we looked at ordinary dense coding. That is, when you use a singlet to send two bits of classical information to Bob, it gives us some success probability. But interestingly, if you use more general form of dense coding, in which you allow for any type of qubit operations here and any type of qubit entanglement here, then you can boost this success probability further. But the main result that we wanted to show was that the connection between the dimension of the channel and the dimension of the entanglement doesn't necessarily have to be symmetric. We managed to find that there exists a four-dimensional entangled state in the source that can then be used using non-reversible channels, that is non-unitary operations, in order to compress this noise into a qubit, which then gives you an even higher success probability. So this led us, I can also say a word about these channels. So here, when you have essentially a two-qubit state coming your way for Alice, your channel amounts to applying a joint unitary on both these qubits, binning one of them and sending the remaining qubit to Bob. And all these operations are combinations of XYZ unitaries at CNOT gates. So it led us to this question, which is central for our work. How can we bound the most general correlations that appear in this experiment in both classical and quantum d-dimensional communication when you're assisted by potentially any amount of entanglement? That is, since we know that you can't restrict the dimension of the entanglement to be the same as that of the channel, let us allow for as much entanglement as possible. So now we want to set out to bound the set of quantum correlations that are possible over a channel assisted by potentially infinite amount of entanglement. And I'm just going to quickly sketch two methods that we have developed for doing this. The first one is very much inspired by the ordinary NPA hierarchy. And I'm going to illustrate it for the case of classical communication over the channel. So again, recall that in the classical case, the state that ends up effectively in Bob's lab is one piece the classical message over the channel and one piece the post-measurement state that Alice remotely prepares for Bob. If you then evaluate the correlations, you end up with a very simple expression that looks like this. Essentially, this derives from state-channel duality. This very much looks like a Bell experiment in the sense that you have a shared state and you have local measurements, M here for Alice preparing the message and M here for Bob extracting the information. The difference is that the outcome or the message of Alice, C, also appears as an input of Bob once he has received the message. But these terms here you see, which are probabilities, they are natural elements of an NPA matrix, although they do not belong to an ordinary Bell experiment. So therefore, one can directly use NPA-type hierarchies in order to bound the set of correlations over a classical channel assisted by unbounded entanglement. I very briefly sketch how you can also do this over a quantum communication channel. So here, the most general operation you have on Alice's side is now a channel. And since we don't limit the dimension, that channel can be a unitary. So if you decompose this unitary and measurement as well on Bob's side, you can write it on this board. It's not too important. The important part is that it eventually leads us to an expression for the correlations that looks like this. Again, rather reminiscent to the classical case, which emerges as a special case, actually. Here you have operators that behave like unitaries on Alice's side and operators that behave as measurements. And again, you can use a modification of the NPA type hierarchy to also constrain these correlations. I will return to this in a bit. The second method that we developed for this is completely different and much more practically oriented. And it's based on a recent notion that we call informational restricted correlations that we have been developing in other works. Here, you're also looking at the prepare and measure scenario, but now you want to ask, how much information do you need to send over the channel in order to make correlations happen? To answer this question, you need to know what you mean by information. And for us, we mean information in the sense of the accessible min entropy. That is what we have I here. This is the min entropy that you have between the random variable X, which is the input of Alice, and the random variable X once you have supplied Bob with the information you sent over the channel. It is essentially the difference in uncertainty before and after communication. And since it's based on min entropy, it takes a simpler form that looks like this. Here, Px is just the distribution over Alice's input, which we know a priori. And this Pg is the guessing probability. That is how well Bob can perform minimal error state discrimination of Alice's input. In other words, how often can you actually get an output that equals Alice's input? This is our information quantity, and we have been investigating this quite intensively in this other work. The reason it's relevant here is this observation. Namely, if you have quantum or classical d-dimensional communication, but assisted by a potentially unbounded amount of entanglement, you can never send more than 2 log d in the quantum case or log d bits over the channel. This is very much in the same spirit as the entanglement-assisted capacity theorem that you encounter in the asymptotic limit of communication. That is that you can double the channel capacity if you allow suitable entanglement between the parties. Here, you have that once again, but now based on our information quantity, which is related to the min entropy. The reason that this is our main observation and relevant at all is that in this work, we developed methods to bound the set of quantum correlations subject to informational restrictions. So that what we encounter now for the problem of our interest is that our original scenario, unbounded entanglement and Q-did communication between Alice and Bob, can be relaxed to an informationally restricted scenario that doesn't feature any entanglement. That is, again, you have Alice and Bob, no entanglement, and Alice is allowed to send the communication that has a min entropy of at most 2 times log d bits. And then we can use our methods from our previous work to find efficient STP relaxations of this information-based problem, which gives us ability to actually bound these correlations in practice. So these are 2 entirely different methods, and I wanted to make a comparison between them. Some things speak in favor of NPA and some things speak in favor of information. In particular, for NPA, we just do one relaxation. We have an original problem and we relax it to an STP, and that's the end of the story. In information, we have a double relaxation. Our original problem first went to an information problem that then went to an STP. So convergence is inherited in the NPA-based approach, basically from the NPA hierarchy immediately, up to the whole ordinary business of tensor products versus commutation, which I don't want to get into. The information-based one is not converging. We know that because we have a counterexample. But usually it tends to converge very, well, not converge, but it used to end up giving very accurate bounds on the quantities we need, which is something I'll return to in a moment. A critical point that speaks in favor of the information approach is how useful the method actually is to do actual computation. The reason is that the NPA-based approach, when you have classical communication, scales very rapidly in terms of operators. So here, the cardinality of X is how many inputs you have on Alice, cardinality of B is how many outputs you have on Bob, and cardinality of Y, how many inputs you have on Bob. And D is the dimension of the communication. You can see that in the NPA version, it's essentially the same as in the information-based one, except that you don't have any D. The information-based hierarchy is independent of the dimension of the channel. In the quantum case of the NPA, the scaling is even worse. It's essentially quadratic in the dimension. Whereas in the information-based one, you still have no dependence on D, and it's the same as in the classical case. So we have some ups and downs for both approaches. So this took us to do some real case studies to see whether they are any good in practice and how they actually compare. Moreover, this also lets us do some natural applications for entanglement-assisted correlations. The first natural one is the notion of a device-independent dimension witness. This topic used to be studied quite intensively many years ago, but indeed, the notion of device independence always hinged on the assumption that there is no entanglement between the devices. But in the most general quantum setting, of course, this is what you encounter. Moreover, we also use these methods to derive some resource inequalities in the spirit of dense coding, which I'll show you right away. So our first example to see if our methods are worth anything is a random access code, which is probably the most well-known simple communication task. Here, Alice has two bits and Bob has a single bit indicating which of Alice's bits he wants to learn. So just like before in our flag game, the task is to answer the wife bit of Alice. This we translate into a witness that we call W. And then we have recycled some well-known bounds from before, saying how well you can perform the random access code if you don't have entanglement. Here C2 means how well you could do it with classical bits, Q2, how well you could do it with qubits, C3, classical trits, and so on. And naturally, when you have four-dimensional classical or quantum objects, you can just send your entire input, so you trivialize the whole problem. So there is a chain of increasingly strong resources, basically. And now we compare this to what we obtain from our methods once we have classical communication assisted by potentially infinite entanglement. Notably, since Alice has four inputs, there is no point in doing a quantum one because you can use dense coding to send your entire input. So the interesting results appear for the classical case. We see that entanglement-assisted bit communication indeed is much more powerful than ordinary bit communication, and is similar for entanglement-assisted trits. Moreover, the bounds we obtain here are tight both with the NPA method and the information method. So they don't teach us anything about their comparative relation, but show us that they are pretty useful, at least in simple tasks. So we scale up to a slightly more sophisticated task, which is essentially the game I presented you for dense coding. Again, you have five inputs, three measurements, but now in addition to performing the random access code, you also want to distinguish the fifth input of Alice from the other four. To make it continuous, we give a weight to how much importance we want to give this discrimination and we call it beta, which then we pick some value for. Then here, now we have five inputs. So we can actually hope to discriminate entanglement-assisted qubits from more general communication. So dense coding isn't enough. What we find using the information-based approach to our problem is that the performance in this task can be limited to a certain number, which happens to be as good as it gets. It's tight through explicit construction. On the other hand, using the NPA type approach, we can't say anything because the problem is simply too demanding. Then we scale up to a slightly more popular game that has been realized in many experiments, but without any entanglement assistance. It's a witness that was proposed in a paper by Gallego and others in 2010. And here, again, you have five inputs on Alice, four on Bob, and then you have a correlation matrix here, translating you into the game you want to solve. Again, here are some known results from papers before ours. Here, you have classical communication and no entanglement. So with bits, trits, quarts, and five-dimensional messages, you get increasingly good numbers. Similarly, the same story goes for quantum without entanglement. Qubits are better than bits, Q-trits are better than qubits and better than trits, and so on. Eventually, you saturate the algebraic maximum of this game. So here we apply our methods to see how they compare. First, we take the classical case with unbounded shared entanglement. So here you have the case of two, three, and four dimensional classical communication. And here these indices, they indicate the best method we have for it. That is, if you have bit communication, we find that indeed the NPA approach is better than the information one. And this is indeed our counterexample to the convergence of the information hierarchy. That is, this number simply cannot be achieved using the information approach. But once you scale up to three-dimensional and four-dimensional communication, the fact that the NPA approach becomes extremely costly takes over, and the sparsity of the information approach makes it a more useful bound. So here we actually get better bounds using our non-converging hierarchy, namely the information-based one. Then we can also compare quantum communication with unbounded shared entanglement. Again, here we have five inputs, so dense coding is not enough to trivialize the task. But if you have entanglement-assisted three-dimensional communication, you could send 9 symbols to Bob, so that would trivialize the task. So the only interesting case is when you have entanglement-assisted qubits. This is a nearly tight bound, over 99% accurate, that we got using the information approach. And again, trying to do the NPA-based approach, over 40 hours of computation, I believe, we still have nothing better than a trivial statement, which is the algebraic bound of this problem. So knowing that our methods could perform decently in several simple tasks, we moved on to construct some resource inequalities. Firstly, we could show, as I mentioned before, that if you have quantum communication, which is informationally restricted to log D bits, this is a more powerful resource than having any amount of entanglement and sending a classical D-dimensional system over a channel. The same thing holds with qubits, so quantum communication over a channel, but now compared to quantum communication of twice the amount of information over the same channel. So these are things that follow immediately from our observation of how you connect informationally restricted correlations to the problem of entanglement-assisted classical and quantum communication. But then we could also use our methods more directly to show two new resource inequalities. The first one is the statement that entanglement-assisted bits are more powerful, strictly more powerful, even in a noise-robust way, than quantum communication of qubits without any shared entanglement, at the very least for binary outcomes. Interestingly though, we could also reverse this statement if we go to qutrits. So if you would have a three-dimensional classical system assisted by infinite entanglement, it's actually not a more powerful resource than a simple qutrit not assisted by any entanglement. So then again, dimension two appears as a sort of anomalous case in terms of how quantum communication relates to entanglement-assisted classical communication. So in conclusion, what we have attempted to do in this work is to initiate a systematic study of preparameasure scenarios supplemented by entanglement. In our case, we focused a lot on unbounded entanglement because we found it conceptually appealing. But in the follow-up work, we are also aiming to look at finite dimensional entanglement and see how the interplay between correlations and the entanglement dimension works out in more detail. But it leaves a lot of open problems and future directions, and I picked out my three favorite ones. The first one is if there actually exists a sufficient entanglement dimension. That is, if you have a qubit channel, can you ever know if there is a sufficient dimension at which you can do all the quantum correlations? Or does there exist some problem where you actually need infinite dimensional entanglement in order to get the strongest predictions of quantum theory? Second one is that our approach is heavily based on SDP relaxations of the quantum set, even when you have classical correlations. And it would be very nice if we could find simple and analytical families of dimension witnesses which are robust to infinite shared entanglement. Many of these dimension witnesses exist in the standard scenario in which you don't have any entanglement involved at all. Entanglement, of course, makes the problem harder, but the question is if it's simple enough that one can obtain such nice and clean statements. And thirdly, our focus was a lot here on the dimension-bounded channels, exclusively. But of course, there are many other approaches to the prepare and measure scenario that I mentioned in the beginning, for example, based on oblivious constraints or distrust or energy or information. How does entanglement change the physics of prepare and measure scenarios in other assumptions than the dimension? So this is essentially the outlook of our work. And with that, I thank you for your attention.
Thanks a lot, Armin. So we have a lot of time for questions.
I have a question. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the it seemed to me that the scenario you're studying has been studied, in particular when you consider the case of classical communication, but quantum entanglement. That's in the context of quantum causal models, that's essentially the instrumental scenario that many people have studied and shown quantum classical gaps for. So am I right that there's that connection? And are you interested in sort of gaps between what you can achieve with classical shared randomness as opposed to that quantum entanglement? Because you didn't mention that.
So indeed, there is a connection to the instrumental scenario. We draw quite a bit of inspiration from it in order to construct our NPA-based approach to relaxing the quantum set, especially for the classical case. But then when you ask about shared randomness as opposed to entanglement, perhaps I misunderstood. Were you meaning that to show the advantages of entanglement over shared randomness in the correlations?
Yes, that's the, I would say, the usual attitude people take towards the instrumental scenario. Can you show a quantum classical gap for the causal structure of the instrumental scenario? And the answer is you can if your X variable is 3 valued, then there are certain inequalities called the Bonet inequalities, which can then be violated by making your source quantum rather than classical shared randomness.
So is this different, for example, from the result implied here, that with a classical bit and shared randomness, you would get some restriction that is smaller than you get with entanglement here? So here's basically shared randomness and classical communication versus entanglement and classical communication. So here we beat the ordinary bit limit.
So I suspect it is different, but I think it's certainly related. So I might be wrong, but I think that would be an example of a quantum classical gap. So you got X is 2 bits. Let's call C the classical variable that gets communicated. So C is 1 bit. And you've got a setting variable Y. So that's different from the instrumental scenario.
No input here.
Yeah, the instrumental scenario doesn't usually have that Y input. It just has an output. So maybe that's the main difference. This is like instrumental with an extra node, which is your Y node that feeds into that final B result. But I don't know, maybe it's still fits inside the umbrella of what you're doing, that if Y were trivial, you could still show this kind of gap between entanglement and just shared randomness. I assume you're allowing the shared randomness when you say without entanglement, you sort of, it's not drawn, but you're allowing it, yes?
Yes, we do.
Yeah.
We actually didn't look at cases where we didn't have any input on Bob, simply because these problems typically trivialize if you restrict the dimension only. But we didn't consider the possibility to show the difference between shared randomness and entanglement in that way. I'll have to look into it a bit.
I don't see the connection to the instrumental scenario at all, because if B is the output, then the random variable which goes sort of in between X and B here is not in your data table. You called it C-Rob, which is this classical thing which is communicated. And so when you talk about compatibility with random access codes, it has nothing to do with the ability to witness instrumental data, because the 3 variables in instrumental data are not the 3 variables that show up here. It's not like Y is extra, there's something missing.
Yeah, you're right, that you'd have to observe the classical system that gets transmitted for it to be like the instrumental scenario. I agree. Okay, so.
And then moreover, if you allow for these sort of common cause, no, I guess then it would be, because X is still in the room.
I have a question. Were you, Rob, were you done I'm sorry if I.
I was just thinking. Let me just continue this for just a minute. So the right. I'm just drawing something to. So hang on a sec. So I think it'd be something like this sort of causal structure. I can't really see very well. So let me see if I can turn on a light. Okay. So Ellie, what you were pointing out, you know, so we mentioned that this Y is something that you don't find in the usual instrumental scenario, but Ellie, you're pointing out that like this variable here, which in the instrumental scenario is observed, in Armin's case, it's not. But nonetheless, so this is maybe more for Ellie, that you know, it is kind of interesting that there could be quantum classical gaps for this kind of causal structure where these things are latent. It's not the usual case that we consider, but I guess all I'm saying is that it would be sort of interesting to figure out, Armin, how to gloss your results as results about quantum classical gaps in causal modeling.
Well, also like Armin said at the beginning of his talk, that without any dimension bound, it trivializes. So there is no quantum classical gap at the level of causal structure, because without a restriction, mm-hmm.
True. Okay, Philip, go ahead.
So it might be the same question. It's just I'm not so familiar with the instrumental scenario. So this entanglement assisted classical communication, it could be also a classical correlation assisted quantum communication, right? Or am I?
No, so when we say that we have entanglement assisted classical communication, we mean that the thing that goes over the channel is classical. But then having quantum communication assisted by classical correlation, that's the ordinary prepare and measure scenario. So that's the figure I have here at the beginning.
Okay.
This one, right? But you have a quantum system going here, and then you have classical correlation from the source.
So this is the one you don't, well, it's so this is studied.
Yeah, this is well studied already.
I have also a question, well, relating this to like all the stuff in quantum communication complexity. Right, there's all sorts of definitions of communication complexity, but one of them, you know, involves unbounded entanglement between the parties. And there are, so what I can see that's different from you is that typically the output has to be a bit. You know, that's normally what they look at. But then have you looked at how your work relates to some of the stuff that's known there?
So we know that several nice results are known on classical communication assisted by entanglement, at least of limited dimension. So for example, there are problems where ordinary classical communication cannot solve a problem with, say, one bit of communication, but one bit is enough if you allow it to be assisted by a suitable entangled state. But I haven't seen any case where you actually need infinite dimensional entanglement to solve a finite problem. So of course, often there you encounter these scalings, right? That you have a polynomial advantage, for example, as the task scales larger. But here, the question that we were really excited about, which we haven't been able to solve, is if there exists a finite scenario, you know, a certain number of inputs, outputs, inputs and outputs here, where infinite dimension is truly needed to do something that you can't do with finite dimension. So this is the thing that gets us really excited. But indeed, we haven't really looked into how the scaling looks if you start trying to scale your problem into complexity ones.
And so it's going to be really an infinite dimension sort of type of like these distinction between very large and infinite that will you think would end up mattering?
Well, I'm not sure it will end up mattering, but I want to know if it exists or not. So we already know that you can't restrict the entanglement dimension to be the same as your communication channel, but we don't also have any bound on this. So just knowing whether there exists a bound at all would be very interesting, I think.
Okay. Thanks. Are there any other questions?
I have a few more. Maybe could you go to your slide where you're defining what I took to be something like a utility function? You had like a matrix C, which you were multiplying by the expectation values. Yeah. So it went by a bit quickly for me, but is W related in a simple way to the probability of success? And how did you get to C, these particular kind of cost function?
So it's one-to-one with the ordinary success probability of answering this question here. We just phrased it in terms of correlators because we wanted to use it in every example the same way. Yeah, but there is a simple map between these two.
I see. So it's just another way of talking about the probability of success.
Exactly. It's entirely one-to-one.
Okay. And then in the case where you had the fifth value, your beta parameter was what sort of set the relative. Yeah. So this isn't, okay. So maybe I misunderstood, but you can't just have a probability of success in this game because when the input was five and Y was one or two, there was kind of no success defined.
Exactly.
Is that related to beta? So how does beta fit into that?
Right. So here, if you have the first four inputs on Alice and the first two inputs on Bob, they are the ordinary random access code. So it's this little submatrix. And then when you have these two events, that is when you have input one or two and input five on Alice, you just ignore the game. So there is no payoff or no penalty.
Okay.
But so then when you do the third measurement, then if you manage to distinguish the fifth input from the other four, then you score a reward, which we call beta. And by tuning this reward, we can change the game and try to fit it into whatever it is we are trying to show. So in the original example, when I said we go beyond dense coding, we just took this beta to be infinity, which was that you have to perfectly distinguish the fifth input from the other four to play the game, which effectively reduces you to a constrained random access code. So it made it easier to talk about the success probability. But here indeed, there is no success probability anymore. There is just a witness, which is based on a random access code.
Okay. Thanks. I have another question. So am I right in thinking that there's no assumption of non-contextuality being made in any of your work? Is that correct?
Yeah, here the only assumption is the dimension.
Got it, right.
Maybe I could actually ask you, do you think substituting the dimension assumption with say obliviousness based one, so a non-contextuality one, would give you very different results from what you get with ordinary contextuality problems? In the case of dimension, we knew that the answer was yes because of dense coding, but for contextuality, it's not so clear.
Can you repeat the question?
So if you have an ordinary contextuality problem, where you say like parity oblivious multiplexing, but now you allow it for having shared entanglement.
Yep.
Would this change anything? Would this give you anything new?
That's a good question. I'm not sure if it would change anything. It might. I think I might have thought about this, but it was many years ago, so I can't, off the top of my head, I can't give you a good answer. Maybe if I went looking through my notes, I could.
Well, can we just say the teleportation becomes possible? So if you have unlimited entanglement and you're allowed to send a bit, effectively it's the same as having no quantum system shared and you can send a qubit.
Well, I guess you would need two bits, no, over the channel.
Yeah.
That's right, you need two bits.
Yes, that is true. one week. Well, I guess that would allow us to say something quite qualitative now about a lot of correlations, because that would reduce the problem, right, to quantum communication without entanglements. Is that right? Yes. But yeah. I think there is a lot of overhead in that, in the sense that doubling the classical communication usually allows you to do much more than sending a quantum bit instead of two bits. So I think it's mostly suboptimal.
Can I make a comment about this? It says it's known that in communication complexity, there are cases where there's exponential advantage when you can send quantum bits instead of classical bits, right? So there's cases where maybe they are artificial or whatever, but it makes a difference sometimes.
But does that work even if you have a finite scenario? So like, is there a case in communication complexity where one qubit beats two bits if you have shared randomness?
I don't know. But if it's an asymptotic scaling thing, then you just pick large enough n, and then there is a big advantage. So
because I think some of the really nice results in communication complexity, like the exponential quantum advantages, they are almost always without shared randomness, like the hidden matching problem, for instance. And I think if you drop the shared randomness, it really changes everything about how powerful classical correlations are. Like, I view shared randomness as a really cheap resource that can really boost the performance of a classical protocol. And I don't know, I would be very keen to see if there actually is an example where you have this exponential scaling, even though you only have shared randomness.
Okay, I'm not sure, but as far as I know, RAS problem is like that. But I it's been a while since I looked at these things.
Have to look it up then.
If I can ask you. Oh, go ahead, Ellie.
I was just wondering if you could drop into the chat some links to these things that you're talking about, hidden matching and RAS's problem. Hidden matching, I'm aware of. RAS's problem, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, there's a nice review by Berman and other people on this. I'll try to find it and I can put it in the chat. I think it has hidden matching as well.
Okay, another question. Can you remind me what's the best result you have regarding a comparison between classical communication versus quantum communication, and where any sort of common cause connection is the same in that comparison?
So the biggest advantage between quantum and classical under unbounded entanglement, or just on the general resources?
Well, it could be under unbounded entanglement. I guess I'm just looking for comparisons where all that changes is the nature of the channel. Communication channel. So I think you had some results like that, maybe where you...
There are definitely examples of that here, but I wouldn't think they are the biggest ones. So say if you just take, for example, this one, right, which is not our result. So these are both without entanglement, where you have quantum advantages. And then here is the analogous thing where you have entanglement, but again, switching between classical and quantum in the channel. But if you just want to make this gap large, maybe in terms of noise, my general experience when working without entanglement is that it's hard to make a really sizable quantum advantage when you have shared randomness involved. With entanglement, we didn't really try to make an analogous really large advantage. But I think it's quite clear that entanglement helps you in that, because already if you use dense coding, you can boost the channel capacity over the classical case. But of course, qubits can't do that over bits. So using that, I'm pretty sure you can get much larger quantum advantages when you allow infinite entanglement. And I suspect dense coding is the biggest one known today.
So I think I'm coming at this from a bit of a different angle. let me try to explain. So while it's true that people tend to compare a single classical bit with a single qubit, my own inclination is to always compare one qubit with two classical bits. So yeah, because, so in my toy theory, for example, you can get, you can, you know, find that the stabilizer formalism for qubits is modeled by a local non-contextual hidden variable model as long as the qubits associated with two classical bits. And so to my mind, the sort of natural, if the world had been like that, then the natural sort of classical theory underlying the qubit would have been two classical bits. And so it wouldn't be surprising to say that, you know, you can do, you can send two classical bits with one qubit. You know, that happens in the toy theory as well. It's not at all surprising. There's no contextuality or non-locality that's required to explain that. So if I look at this slide, it seems to me that when you have, for example, entanglement assistance, and you look at one qubit and two classical bits, you get exactly 13.095. It completely coincides.
So this is, there is a reason for this, and it's not deep at all. It's because both of these are based on the information relaxation, which doesn't distinguish these two. Because here you have a channel capacity of 2 bits, and here you also have that. So it's only because of the relaxation. This is not fundamental. But now when you said this, maybe I know that, might know the result you, if you want to hear. So this didn't appear here, but this is a follow-up work where we have managed to show that there exist cases where you can use entanglement to assist a qubit in such a way that the correlations cannot be simulated by 2 bits. So it's beyond that coding in that sense. Right. We need more classical information.
Right. It did sound like you had a result like that in this talk, but maybe I'm... that was your flagged game, wasn't it?
It's beyond that coding thing in the beginning.
Yeah, what was that result?
This one, let's see. So here, yes, I guess this would also imply that. Indeed, because here dense coding, that's 2 bits, and you can already go beyond that. Right, fair enough, yes, it's here.
Okay, so this is the case where you demand that success just means whenever y was 1 or 2, you guessed the correct bit. And when y is 3, you perfectly distinguish 5 from the rest. That's the game here.
Exactly.
And so and when you, the dense coding one is, if you imagine that the qubit was replaced by 2 c-bits, here's your probability of success. That's the idea?
Exactly.
Okay. And but hang on, was that under the assumption that you have 2 qubits of shared entanglement? Because on your third column, you're assuming you have two four-level systems of shared entanglement. So isn't that different entanglement resources in the two cases?
Okay. So you mean that you would have 4-dimensional entanglement shared here and then send 2 bits over the channel?
Yeah. Like I want a comparison where the only thing that changes is the channel is either 1 qubit or 2 c-bits. The entanglement resources are the same across the comparison, and then there would be, you know, potentially a quantum advantage. So I, if I'm not mistaken, though, like this table doesn't provide such an example because your dense coding is just 2 qubits of entanglement. Is that, have I got that right?
It does provide that here in the middle.
Right. Okay, the middle one is it. So the middle one is 2 qubits of entanglement, 1 qubit of communication. Whereas dense coding is 2 qubits of entanglement and 2 c-bits of information.
No, sorry, actually it doesn't. It just doesn't provide the
result. Yeah, that's what it's one.
Because dense coding is just 2 bits with nothing. Nothing, no entanglement.
Oh.
And this, right? That is a qubit assisted by a singlet, which is effectively 2 classical bits without entanglement. So the answer isn't in the table. But we didn't look at that, but off the top of my head, I think it is certainly possible to find an example like that. It wouldn't surprise me, but it's not here.
Okay. I think I would be surprised if you could find a result like that, so.
Oh, well, that makes it more fun to try to show it.
Do we have any more questions?
I just wanted to get some clarification on the very second to last slide, Armin. You have these sort of resources inequalities, and I wanted to know whether those are meant to be interpreted as strict or just sort of an ordering.
Here.
Yes.
Right. So these two are strict. So informationally restricted quantum communication with double channel capacity is strictly more powerful than entanglement assisted classical or quantum communication. So this is general. This here is also strict when you have binary outcomes in your measurements. When you don't have binary outcomes, we don't know whether it's strict or not. So here, this is even noise tolerant to quite a substantial degree. This one, so I put not equal to in the sense that these are incomparable. There exist problems where this one is better than this one and the opposite. And this is what we showed, because so the previous result was that it's known that that this one indeed can do essentially anything that this one can, but under additional assumptions. But in our framework, we could sort of relax these additional assumptions, which try to connect entanglement assisted communication to Bell inequalities and find that indeed it goes both ways. They're just incomparable.
Thanks.
All right. So if we have no more questions, I think we should thank Armin again. It was nice to have you. And yeah.
All right. Thanks for having me. It's fun to be here.